As a chef and a restaurant owner, I'm as meticulous about my cookware as I am about my ingredients. That's why I love Made In Cookware. Each pan they make isn't just designed to perform, it's crafted to last. As a mom, I love that I can trust Made In. It's made from the world's finest materials, so I can feel good about what I'm feeding my family. I'm Chef Brooke Williamson, and I use Made In Cookware. Shop chef quality pots and pans at madeincookware.com.
Welcome back to Pod Save the World. This is Tommy Vitor. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. My guest this week is Derek Chollet. I will go through his resume with you later. Initially, this conversation was going to be a big wrap-up of Trump's trip to the G20, but today is Russia madness all the time. So we started there, Don Jr.'s meetings with Russian lawyers and other officials trying to gather dirt on Hillary. And then we got into the ongoing military effort against ISIS in Mosul, what's happening in Syria, and the Trump administration's plans for Afghanistan. I think it's hard to focus on these hugely important issues like ISIS, Iraq, Syria, when all this madness is in the news. But Derek gave us a great perspective on both. So check it out. With me this week on Pod Save the World is Derek Chollet. Derek was, from 2012 to 15, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. That means he dealt with defense policy towards Europe. That includes NATO, the Middle East, Africa, and the entire Western Hemisphere. So big, big job there. Before joining the Pentagon, Derek was at the White House as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Strategic Planning on the National Security Staff. And before that, he was Deputy Director of Secretary Hillary Clinton's Policy Planning Staff and a member of the Obama-Biden transition team. Derek, thanks for joining me today, man. I appreciate it.
It's great to be here, Tommy.
So, of course, as usual, what happens with the show is I pitch you on one idea, which was like, let's do a Trump trip wrap up. And then the news cycle explodes 85 times over, including our boy Don Jr. sending some probably troubling emails to some Russian counterparts. So I figured we would start there instead, just because I hope you can help us make sense of this, given your expertise in defense
yeah,
and campaigns.
Yeah, let's just go right to the pain.
Let's go. Okay. So after months of denials by the Trump administration that there was any contact with Russian officials during the campaign, it came out today that Donald Trump Jr. took a meeting with a Russian lawyer after being promised information that, quote, would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. They added, this is obviously very high level and sensitive information, but it is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump. Feels pretty bad. This is brand new. You know, it's hard for me to get my bearings when I read things like that. But I'm wondering, you know, to begin, what do you make of all this?
Well, I mean, it's hard to get your bearings. I mean, it's pretty shocking, yeah, to be honest. I mean, it's because it's not just that he was meeting with individuals who happened to be Russian, right? I mean,
yeah.
I think we that was clear. The way the story's evolved in the last 72 hours has been a little head-spinning.
But oh, yeah.
It went from, okay, he met with some Russians, unclear whether they were how they were connected to the government or not, to then what we have now is black and white, clear as day evidence that it was his understanding he was going to meet individuals who had Russian government information, mm-hmm, that could be provided to him that would be damaging to Clinton. And I think for many of us who've been watching this unfold over the last several months or more, almost a year now, actually, from when these first allegations first arose, there's at least an assumption of unwitting collusion, meaning
right,
that perhaps people around the Trump organization or as part of the Trump organization met with folks who maybe unwittingly were working on behalf of the Russians, and there was collusion there, but there's no ambiguity based on this email chain that was released about, you know, who was doing what on whose behalf. I mean, it says these Russians, Russian government officials,
yeah,
Russian government lawyer, even is the way this person was described. So it's pretty startling. I mean, this is something Tommy, you and I have worked on campaigns before.
Right.
You know, what the Trump guys are trying to say is, hey, look, Oppo research, this is nothing new. You know, this is what happens all the time. I mean, if first of all, I've never been even, you know, directly or even heard of a foreign government trying to provide this kind of information. And if that ever had occurred in any campaign I'd been a part of, you know, one of the first calls you'd make is to the FBI to say something extremely fishy is going on here.
Yeah. I mean, your point about the sort of unwitting collusion, I think for a while people thought, well, maybe sort of bumbling Carter Page accidentally got had took meetings with the wrong people, or shady Paul Manafort, you know, tried to make a quick buck with the wrong people in Ukraine. This is very witting. And to your point earlier about opposition research, absolutely, opposition research is standard operating procedure in any campaign. That said, I mean, I remember in 2008, there were bright lines drawn by Barack Obama, David Plouffe, David Axelrod, the senior people on the campaign, about what we would and would not look into or talk about or use. And you would think that foreign government information would be part of that, would be, you know, firmly on the wrong side of that line. But, you know, so you worked in government, you did a bunch of campaigns, you were a foreign policy expert. I mean, did you have foreign officials trying to take meetings with you during Kerry Edwards or any other campaigns? And did you have those conversations? Like, how did you draw the line between gathering information to get policy, to build policies, or, you know, while preventing sort of inappropriate conversations?
Yeah, no, and I think what's happening as a result of this, particularly because the Trump people or their supporters are trying to kind of throw a lot of chaff up into the air to kind of distract us from what's going on. And because it's absolutely true that campaign officials will have interactions with foreign government officials, more likely. It's, you know, folks based here in Washington, here at U.S. embassies or at their embassies here in Washington, or perhaps if foreign officials are traveling in the United States at that time, and they'll reach out to the foreign policy advisors of the campaign to understand the campaign's position on issues. Obviously they want to try to establish relationships, thinking that if these people win, then of course those folks could be in positions inside the government.
Right.
So my experience is, yes, there was interaction with foreign governments. It typically, though, were, in my experience, were interactions with governments that were friendly to us.
I mean, right.
You know, it's not uncommon to have talk to the Brits or talk to the French or talk to the Japanese or the Koreans or longstanding allies. Pretty unusual, and I don't recall any situation that I was a part of where we would talk to the Russians, for example. Yes, it's true that campaigns will interact with foreign governments, but not foreign governments that are seeking to undermine our election, for sure.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's very unusual.
That's a good point, right? You see a lot of campaign trips to Israel or
the
UK.
And again, those tend to be more informational exchanges. Certainly nothing of what we're seeing right now, not even close of this, you know, I've got some information that is going to undermine your opponent. Nothing of that nature. It's more, you know, what is your candidate's position on, you know, issue XYZ that I care about, or let me, as a foreign government official, tell you about our position on policy XYZ.
Yeah.
And typically those are handled, I mean, for the most part, I think on both sides, Republican and Democrat, in past elections responsibly, and oftentimes these are relationships that one may carry, have, you know, made outside of government, or, you know, folks, for those of us who had served in government before, perhaps people you had interacted with before. We don't want to, in criticizing what's happening to Trump, you don't want to sort of paint with too broad of a brush, meaning saying that so forever, you know, campaigns would never interact with foreigners. That's not smart. But what's happened here is just so beyond the pale.
Yeah.
It's not an apples and oranges comparison. It's an apples and some totally different comparison.
It's so funny listening to a reasonable person like yourself try to be charitable to them, because I do this too. It's like I struggle so mightily.
Well, I mean, it's just batshit crazy.
Yeah. It is indeed. Okay. Last question for you on this. You did a lot of work at the Pentagon on policy towards Europe, policy towards NATO, which is of extreme acute interest to the Russian government. They would likely collect on someone in your position, their military, their intelligence services.
Yep.
I'm guessing you got your fair share of counterintel briefings. I mean, what's your sort of, without any real knowledge beyond what we've both read, take on the tactic here? Is sort of running an intermediary like this, an acquaintance of Trump's, a lawyer, to launder Russian government information, does that sound like something that would be a known tactic or something we would watch out for?
Yeah, it sounds very plausible. Again, not knowing the specifics of what was going on in this case beyond what we've all just been reading over the last, you know, it's been released here. But it absolutely, I mean, look, Putin has shown, whether it's in specific intelligence operations or in situations like his invasion of Ukraine several years ago, which he uses cutouts, he uses intermediaries, he tries to throw up enough ambiguity that he can claim that he has nothing to do with it, right? And so, you know, even though the facts show otherwise, he can have plausible deniability.
Right.
So I'm sure in this instance, I have not seen the Russian government's reaction to the release of this information about Donald Trump Jr. today. They've reacted in the past on this about, you know, denying anything. But I assume they'll say, look, we had nothing to do with any of this. These were just folks who, you know, weren't part of the government. They were not formal officials purporting to have this information. We had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
I don't believe that. And it's sort of like when Trump last week had this meeting with Putin in Germany and said, you know, we talked about this the Russian interference question and, you know, we're moving on. I mean, of the people in that room, and there were six of them, two of them were interpreters and four, Tillerson, Trump, Putin, and Lavrov, the foreign minister. I mean, other than the interpreters, no one in that room has any credibility on the Russian hacking issue.
Right.
So, you know, we shouldn't believe anybody what they're saying about that of the four folks in that room.
Yeah, it's I don't know how as a reporter you bother going to a briefing, you quote these denials anymore. I mean, they're just a shred of their credibility. But
yeah,
more nerdy foreign policy coming up on Pod Save the World. Support for Pod Save the World comes from the International Rescue Committee. The IRC works in more than 50 countries, serving people whose lives have been upended by war, conflict, and natural disasters. In places like Gaza, Ukraine, and Sudan, displaced families are experiencing war, extreme hunger, and life-threatening injuries. In Gaza, ongoing violence, bombardment, and blockade have made survival difficult for families living in damaged buildings and tents. The lack of safe water, medicine, and healthy food contributes to the spread of diseases, and children are especially at risk. The International Rescue Committee is working with local partners in Gaza to provide life-saving medical care to injured civilians. The IRC works around the world to help families in crisis by delivering critical supplies such as therapeutic food for malnourished children, clean water, cash assistance, and more. Your donation will support this work and help children and families survive. Listen, the International Rescue Committee is an incredible organization. They are doing the Lord's work all around the globe. I have donated to them, you know, for many, many years now because I know that my dollar will go towards helping people. It's not going to go to administrative costs or overhead fees. It's just an incredible group doing great work. I hope you'll consider them. Donate today by visiting rescue.org/rebuild. That's rescue.org/rebuild. Pod Save the World is brought to you by the UN Refugee Agency. The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations, and they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation. That's unrefugees.org/donation. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Am I all out of conversation juice, Lovett?
Yeah.
It's a famous Lovett line at a dinner where you just didn't feel like talking anymore.
I was coming down, shall we say, and a very famous person was talking to me, and I just looked them in the eyes and said, I'm out of conversation juice.
It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially when social gatherings picking up after the winter. What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy,
Give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/crookedworld. Go today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/crookedworld.
So the other huge event in the news the past few days and this week is the recapturing of Mosul. The Iraqi Prime Minister al-Abadi declared recently that Mosul had been recaptured from ISIS. The images out of Mosul are stark. I mean, the city
it's like Dresden.
It's Dresden, terrible. Which was, you know, bombed to smithereens in World War II. Yeah. It's flattened. The human suffering is unbelievable. But I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the significance of this military success against ISIS.
Well, this is a watershed moment, and it's one that, just to kind of bring people back in time, I mean, it was 3 years ago this summer when ISIS first took Mosul and you know, began the quick march towards Baghdad, and I was serving in the Pentagon at the time, and it was a harrowing moment where for a period of time, we thought we were watching Iraq unravel completely, because Mosul's a major city in Iraq, major city in, and the fact that ISIS had taken that over relatively easily at the time was quite alarming.
Can you just talk about that for 1 second, Derek? Because basically, the Iraqi security forces, after a decade plus of training and equipment from the United States, just turned
melted
and
away,
ran, right? Yeah,
basically, and there's a variety of reasons for that. You know, the U.S., after withdrawing from Iraq in 2011, which was something the Iraqis wanted us to do, was to withdraw. They did not have for several years, they didn't have the United States by their side, helping them stay trained up. And then also the leadership of Iraq after we withdrew in 2011 was very sectarian, so sort of played on the differences of the people of Iraq, particularly between Sunni and Shia. And as a result, we had a kind of an atrophy of the Iraqi security forces, which then when ISIS rose up and went into Mosul, they basically just folded like a house of cards.
Right.
So that's when the beginning of the ISIS campaign started 3 years ago this summer. I think it's also really important for your listeners to remember that when President Obama started this campaign, this military campaign 3 years ago, he made very clear at the time that this was going to be, we would win militarily. We would be able to have the kind of success we've seen in Mosul today, but it was going to take time.
Yeah.
In fact, he said it would take about 2 to 3 years. And guess what? It took about 2 to 3 years. It was interesting. I was reflecting back on this. It was 2 years ago, almost to the day, right after July 4th, 2015, President Obama went to the Pentagon for a briefing of his senior military leadership on the progress in the ISIS campaign, and then delivered a public speech at the Pentagon, an update on the ISIL campaign. And he made very clear in that statement, he talked mainly about the progress that the United States and its partners had been making in Iraq and Syria against ISIS, saying we had a long way to go militarily, but that we were making steady progress. But he made very clear that no amount of military force was going to end the terror that is ISIS, that unless it was matched by a broader effort and in the political and economic questions that really address the underlying conditions that created ISIS. And that's now where we find ourselves.
Right. Was that briefing in the tank, Derek?
The briefing itself was not in the tank, which is where the Joint Chiefs, that's their conference room. It was in the Secretary's conference room, and then Secretary of Defense's conference room, and then he gave a public statement, I believe, in the Pentagon press room. Your listeners should just Google Obama ISIS July 2015, and you'll see his full speech.
I just wanted to name check the tank because it was just the coolest name for a conference room, I think,
exactly.
Ever. I
mean,
I'm not sure why it's special.
For those of you who've never been in the tank, you go in there, it's just a conference room. It doesn't look anything like a tank.
It's like the Situation Room, right? The Situation Room is three or four actually different rooms, three or four
exactly.
that are just secure facilities where you can do a video conference. But anyway,
but I mean, so I think, you know, what's interesting, I mean, you know, what's happened in Mosul in the last few days has nothing to do with Donald Trump, to be clear. I mean, this was the military campaign that had been designed and begun under President Obama that the Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, Secretary Mattis has continued with in the first 7 months of this year. And I remember at the very beginning when this military plan was being developed, we knew that we would eventually come to this day, eventually, just given the capability of the United States and our efforts working with our partners, that we would take back Mosul. Mm-hmm. It would be a long, hard fight, but it would happen. But the question is, what comes next?
Right.
And this is where it has been deafening silence coming out of the Trump administration. It's unclear that they have any plan of what to do. This is something that was acutely on the Obama administration's mind as it was leaving office, knowing that we were going to get to this point where we would be able to militarily liberate these places. But then what comes next is the hard work and the significant resources that are going to be required to stabilize what are devastated cities and towns in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And this is where we're going to need strong diplomacy, and unfortunately we're getting the opposite of that right now. We're going to need affected development experts, and we're going to need international unity. And right now we're falling short on all three.
So staying with Iraq, I mean, at least there's a government, right? At least there's someone we can work with, unlike Syria, right, where it's Assad and ISIS
exactly.
sort of dividing the place up. What would you recommend that the Trump administration do in Syria over the next 6-12 months? I'm sorry, in Iraq.
In Iraq. Well, I mean, look, the key is to continue to ensure that with our military trainers, and it's important, again, for your listeners to remember what the U.S. has been doing in Iraq is direct military action, mainly through airstrikes and then some special forces work. But mainly we're training and equipping the Iraqi security forces. So the liberation of Mosul was done by Iraqi troops with our support, with our U.S. air power, U.S. intelligence, U.S. equipment in many cases. But it was the Iraqis actually on the ground doing the work. Mm-hmm. So it's important for us to continue to work with them, assuming the Iraqis, and they do want us to continue to work with them, but to make sure that they are, you know, have the capabilities that they need to stabilize these parts of Iraq that have been liberated, and then also to help lead the world. Which again, I'm not very confident we're going to do this, but we've got to help lead the world in what is going to be a massive effort that's required to help stabilize these places. It's going to require, probably, you know, I think the recent estimates I've seen, it's nearly $1 billion in reconstruction support that's required. Again, a lot of political development support, and you know, when the ISIS campaign started, we knew that we would be able to break the back of the Islamic State, because actually, taking down states is something the U.S. military has shown multiple times that it's capable of doing in the last 15 years.
If you're holding territory, we can figure out a way.
You're right. Cutting off the finances, taking guys off the battlefield, you know, taking down the leadership structure, we can take down states. The challenge for us is when ISIS goes back to being an insurgency, mm-hmm. which is where we are now.
Right.
And that's a harder... That's a harder problem to try to tackle, and it's not something the U.S. there's easy answers to at all. The problem is, again, we are kind of undercutting the tools that we have to try to get at that part of the problem by what this administration's done just in only 6 months in office.
So, I mean, it's interesting. I agree. It's like, in a weird way, this was the easy part, and easy is by no means easy, right? But your point about the longer term commitment and what it'll take to get Iraq to a place that's self-sustaining and safe for the people who live there is, you know, I saw something by David Petraeus, who was talking about our commitment to Afghanistan the other day.
Yep.
And he drew a comparison to Korea, where we've been for decades, and we have 20,500 troops there since 1953. So, I mean, Have we all been thinking about Iraq wrong for the last 5-10 years? I mean, was thinking we needed a time frame for withdrawal and capacity building for these forces just naive? Or, you know, is Petraeus right about that time frame? Like, what? How do you look at this now, having worked on this for so long?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, and you know, Iraq is a, is obviously each of these cases kind of have to take on their own. And Iraq, you know, the story of our withdrawal from Iraq in 2011, and then the reintroduction of U.S. military forces into Iraq in 2014 has been highly litigated. It's important, I think, that for people to remember that the Iraqis have a vote here, and they were willing to see us leave in 2011. Right. They had been through a searing experience, clearly, in the what had happened in the previous decade. And it's actually a different story in Afghanistan, where the U.S. has been in Afghanistan, of course, since 2001. And we still have north of 10,000 troops there. We're adding, it looks about to be around 4,000 more.
Right.
And I know we're going to get to Afghanistan in a bit, a little more, but you know, if anyone in 2011 or 2001 had said U.S. troops are going to be in Afghanistan for the next 16 years plus, because, I mean, I don't see them leaving anytime soon, we're starting to look a little bit like Korea, right? Yeah. Now, different circumstance. Afghanistan is a pretty tough terrain and far more dangerous than Korea was in the 50s and 60s in terms of day-to-day life for our folks out there deployed. But I think these sorts of long-term investments are ones that we should be prepared to make. But it is also important that we have partners on the ground. And I think this is a key kind of thing to keep in mind, which is in both cases now in Afghanistan and Iraq, we have governments who want us there, who want to work with us, who want our help. And that's critical to success. And I think what we found ourselves in 2011, and I was part of the decisions that were taken about our withdrawal of troops, is we had an Iraqi government at the time that was more than happy for us to leave and really didn't want us to stay. And that seemed like a recipe for disaster as well.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to Pod Save the World. Stick around. There's more great show coming your way.
As a chef and a restaurant owner, I'm as meticulous about my cookware as I am about my ingredients. That's why I love Made In Cookware. Each pan they make isn't just designed to perform, it's crafted to last. As a mom, I love that I can trust Made In. It's made from the world's finest materials, so I can feel good about what I'm feeding my family. I'm Chef Brooke Williamson, and I use Made In Cookware.
With my busy life, I use Shipt same-day delivery to keep up. When I need a jar of extra creamy peanut butter delivered, I know my personal shopper Amber will come through. And if it's not on the shelf, she asks them to check the back. Shipt, delight in every delivery. Learn more at Shipt.com.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Turning quickly to Syria, during the President Trump's bilateral meeting with President Putin, he announced a ceasefire in southwestern Syria. So far, that ceasefire appears to be holding. There have been any number of unsuccessful ceasefire efforts in Syria. Secretary Kerry brokered a number of them that just didn't hold.
Yeah.
This one seems unique in that Russia is driving it. What do you make of this effort? Do you think that there's a hope here that this could improve the situation on the ground?
Yeah, look, there's a hope. I mean, one has to always hope. You're right to point out, though, that we have seen many ceasefires come and go over the course of the last 6 years in Syria. This, because it's of where it is, the role that Russia is playing, in particular, that this could be different. You know, this is a part of Syria that, in the southwest part, where it's pretty far from the fighting that we've been most engaged in eastern Syria, and the northern part of Syria, where Aleppo is, and It's part of Syria that there's been a lot of focus on recently because our Jordanian partners who were part of this agreement are very focused on what's happening in the southwest part of Syria. Our Israeli friends are very nervous about what's going on in that part of Syria because that's the part of Syria that's adjacent to Israel. So there's a lot of players who want to see this ceasefire succeed. There's a concern about Iran using this part of Syria as gaining influence in this part of Syria. So, you know, it's been, what, I think 24 hours or a little over 24 hours since the ceasefire took effect as we're talking today. So I'm hopeful, but I'm not confident.
Yeah.
It's a pretty tricky deal, and there's been some reporting about, you know, the U.S. military not fully kind of being caught surprised by some elements of the ceasefire. So I'm unclear what's happened there.
Yeah, you're being very generous.
This is something, by the way, I don't think this was something that was much discussed by Trump and Putin. I think a lot of the work was being done at lower levels over the past several weeks, and this was one of these things they saved for the Putin-Trump meeting to be able to announce as a deliverable.
Got it. Yeah, you're being very generous. According to BuzzFeed, the U.S. military had received no guidance on how to enforce a ceasefire, even as they were talking about this as a success.
But the other thing is, I don't think we're really operating much there.
Right.
I mean, most of where the U.S. military is operating, if folks look at a map of Syria, is more kind of at the central and the eastern part, not the southwestern part. So,
got it. I mean, is the heavy lifting here to get the Russian buy-in, and we shouldn't worry as much about the execution, or how do you view this?
I think maintaining Russian buy-in is going to be key. I think the question in my mind is how much control do the Russians actually have over things there? It's one of these million-dollar questions. You know, the Russians are not all-powerful, so getting them to try to cooperate is hard enough, but then there's always the question of how much leverage do they actually have,
right?
And so this will be the additional test, is whether they've got the will to enforce this ceasefire and to force their friends to stand down. But then there's also whether they got the way, whether they've actually got the ability to do it.
Right. Yeah.
And that's what I'll be watching for over the next week or so. But
yeah,
you know, I think I've seen this too many times to get to be I'm hopeful because I want it. Of course, we want a ceasefire. I'm just not optimistic. It's kind of the whole Lucy, the Charlie Brown thing, Lucy and the football.
Yeah,
you know, we've seen them pull the football several times already. So
yeah, I mean, ultimately, Assad is their guy. They want to continue to prop him up, and we don't like Assad, and we don't like ISIS. And it's hard to see how that's a big opening for cooperation, but hope springs eternal.
Exactly.
The last question I would ask you is about Afghanistan. According to the New York Times on Tuesday, Steve Bannon pitched General Mattis on a plan to send the private security firm Blackwater into Afghanistan instead of more U.S. troops.
Yeah.
It's apparently a way to give Trump more options to keep his promise to put America first. I think this sounds crazy. Blackwater was a disaster in Iraq. There was a horrific incident where a dozen plus, I think it was 17 civilians were shot by Blackwater forces. I've seen no evidence that using a private army saves taxpayers money or would be more effective in implementing policy. But you are an expert. You've probably worked in and around these private security forces and obviously a lot with the U.S. military. What's your take on that story?
Well, it's kind of hard to know where to begin. I mean, look, at the most charitable interpretation, which is that, you know, as I said, we're going to be in Afghanistan one way or another for a long time, right? And Afghanistan, for folks who've never been, it's an incredibly insecure environment. And private security contractors are absolutely critical to functioning safely in Afghanistan, whether you're there as a U.S. government official, you're there as a journalist, you're there as an NGO providing development assistance. There are private security contractors kind of all over the place, right? And they keep a lot of people safe, and we rely on them. So there's nothing inherently bad about security contractors. And the other thing is, like, it's perfectly fine for a government to have creative ideas to try to explore every option. And certainly the U.S. military even uses private security contractors because that's a way that It can keep its military footprint at a minimum, but still be secure enough to be able to do the work. Okay, but the way this is kind of all going down, according to the New York Times, raises a lot of flags. I mean, clearly, Eric Prince, who used to run Blackwater, now it's the firm has another name that I'm forgetting.
Evil Corp, I think. Something like
yeah,
that.
I forget what it's called, but it's been. You know, he has a vested interest in having, you know, a business interest in having this, you know, be taken over by security contractors. He himself is someone who's, you know, has some, you know, is a political supporter, and there's kind of raises a lot of ethical flags in kind of getting this kind of advice from him. The Steve Bannon role in all of this is very interesting and alarming. You know, much was made by the quote unquote adults in the Trump administration, and I use quotes around adults purposely, that, you know, people like Bannon had been banished from the national security decision-making system.
Right.
But this suggests that, you know, is not true.
I mean, just pausing on that, could you imagine David Axelrod walking up to Bob Gates and saying, hey, instead of sending 10,000 Marines to Helmand Province, what if we sent
Blackwater? And Tommy, Blackwater? It's worse than that, because it's not just like a great, you know, hey, I had this idea on my own. It's, hey, I've spent all this time consulting with folks outside of government who have a vested financial interest in a certain policy outcome. What
right.
do you think?
Right.
I mean, it's not just I read an interesting, you know, think tank report, and what do you think of this? I've actively brought folks from outside of government in who have a vested interest.
It's like they had a contest to solicit the worst possible ideas, and this is where they landed.
It's not, you know, I can only imagine what General Mattis's reaction was to all of this.
Just get out of my face.
You know, so.
Yeah. Okay, I think we both landed on probably not a good idea. Derek, thank you so much for doing the show.
I know this was
like the craziest day possible to have these conversations. And thank you for providing insight not only to this Russia madness, but all the really, really important things that are happening behind the scenes that are not getting the attention they deserve, like Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. So thanks.
Yeah, man. No. Well, look, I appreciate you doing it. And it's just a good reminder that the world is not stopping while we sort our shit out.
No, it is not.
So, it is not. You know. It's a pretty disturbing time.
Yeah, it sure is. And with that, thanks.
All right.
Talk to you
thanks,
soon.
Thanks, Tommy. I appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
As a chef and a restaurant owner, I'm as meticulous about my cookware as I am about my ingredients. That's why I love Made In Cookware. Each pan they make isn't just designed to perform, it's crafted to last. As a mom, I love that I can trust Made In. It's made from the world's finest materials, so I can feel good about what I'm feeding my family. I'm Chef Brooke Williamson, and I use Made In Cookware. Shop chef quality pots and pans at madeincookware.com.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.